All right, we're having a little bit of a different intro this episode. I was having some technical difficulties, and the people at Restream, who are amazing, and Restream is an amazing product that I use to do my live streams and then upload my audio to my podcast, they have been above and beyond as far as customer service. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to play the intro. In the past like 3 weeks, if you've noticed and you're listening on the podcast, there hasn't been an intro maybe the last couple of weeks. And prior to that, there was an echo in it, and I really couldn't figure it out. So they have gone above and beyond. And so I'm going to play the intro as I have in the last 3 weeks, which the last two have been cut off. I just went right to the podcast itself. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play the intro now. And if it echoes, it echoes. I don't know. It's one of those things when they're paying attention, it won't happen. It's like a dogs and little kids will prove you wrong every time. Oh, watch, my dog does this trick. No, he doesn't. Oh, watch my child. She's going to do this. No, she doesn't. Now this won't echo. Although I can't hear it, it's only on the replay that I find it. So, without further ado, here we go. And again, the people at Restream are amazing. And I think they're watching right now to see what happens. So, here we go. You're all part of the experiment. As Mark Smith said, we're all living in a Petri dish right now. A big live stream Petri dish. And podcast Petri dish. That's a pretty good name for a podcast. The Podcast Petri Dish. Don't steal my ideas.
This podcast is sponsored by Great White Hot Sauce. It's a small batch, handmade hot sauce made specially for you. So if you like hot sauce, you'll love Great White Hot Sauce. It's the hot sauce that bites back. Find it at www.trygreatwhite.com.
Well, here we are, episode 68. On this episode, once again, I have Mark Smith from the Music Relish Podcast. He's back in the seat. We're going to talk about the tribute concert to Taylor Hawkins, the late, great Taylor Hawkins. I can say he's great. We're going to talk about what music we were listening to in the 90s. Always interesting. And I'm going to ask him 5 trivia questions. I like that segment. Let's see how he does. Enjoy the show.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have...
The KOFB Studio presents Milk Crates and Turntables, a music discussion podcast hosted by Scott McLean. Now, let's talk music. Enjoy the show.
Thank you, Amanda, for that wonderful introduction as usual. Welcome to the podcast. You know the name, I'm not going to say it. We're streaming live right now over YouTube, Facebook, Twitch, Twitter, and DLive. Jack's not here again this week. He seems to be, he comes and goes more than the prodigal son. But, hey, that's okay. I got a good substitute for him. The one, the only Mark Smith, Music Relish guy! Uh-oh. I can't hear him. I can't hear you.
All right, so the copyright for Petri Dish podcast, done. Okay. Hey, how you doing?
Yeah. You're a funny guy.
How you doing, Scott?
Stealing my ideas. Oh, kind of was your idea.
Yeah, but I had the microphone on mute. I'm an idiot.
That's all right. Yeah, the Petri Dish podcast. That can go a number of different ways, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Might be onto something, buddy. You do work in a hospital, right?
Yeah.
Are there stories that come out of hospitals?
Oh, God. Yeah.
Soap opera stories, drama stories, comedy stories.
It's an environment that's under intense pressure all the time. So there's stories.
Plenty of stories.
I always like talking to the emergency department people.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. All right. Those are the best stories.
So what's been going on in Music Relish?
We had a really cool show. It was me. I was slow. We talked about cowbells this past week. It was cool because everyone thinks of the normal cowbell stuff, but we brought up some good songs that you didn't, you know, cowboy. Yeah. So, yeah. And then we talked about the Taylor Hawkins tribute, which just looked incredible. I haven't heard it yet, but it went good.
What was the first thing you guys talked about?
Cowbell.
Yeah.
You got the prop. We should have had something like that.
I got the cowbell.
Yeah.
I got the cowbell. Ah, buddy.
And we're forbidden from mentioning Don't Fear the Reaper because Tom Spallone says no talk of BOC, no talk of Stephen Wilson, and no talk of REM.
What?
But when I do mention any of them, I do this, you know, just for Tom.
Why can't you talk about?
Because we talk about it too much. Lou's a big BOC fan. I'm a big Stephen Wilson Porcupine Tree fan. And Perry and Lou are both huge REM fans. So he kind of said we're talking about him a little too much, but he's probably right.
So you're the ELP guy, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So my wife and I, Dr. Vera, we were out to dinner the other night with another couple, Dr. Perman and his wife, and come to find out that he's in a band and they do like Steely Dan. They do a lot of, you know, like classic rock stuff and they like contemporary jazz and stuff like that. So the question comes up during, because then it just turned to music between me and him and the wives just kind of sat there, right? Although they enjoyed the conversation. And I asked him, okay, who's the best drummer? Who's the best drummer? He went, oh, geez. He said, you know, he names off, you know, Ginger Baker, and then he goes kind of off. He has a little depth in that field. And who do you think he mentioned as who he thought was one of the best drummers?
Carl Palmer.
There you go. That's what he
said. Wow. Yeah.
He likes him. Yeah. I said, oh, I got to tell my buddy Mark about that one.
I'm actually going to see him in November.
Oh, yeah?
He's the last surviving member.
Yeah.
All the other two. So he's doing a tour where he's going to have video backdrops. I don't think there's money for holograms, you know. So he's doing the money, you know, back. And I'm seeing him at a small college in New Jersey, a very small auditorium. That'll be fun.
All right.
Yeah.
How do you think he is financially?
I say not nearly as good as Greg Lake and Keith Emerson, only because when they were alive, they had those songwriting royalties coming in. Carl Palmer has steadily been touring all these years, every year. In fact, it's like if you have probably four chances to see Carl Palmer a year, and it's not overkill. I just think that's his day job. He tours, and that's how he makes his money.
Ah.
So he's always in this area, and he's always in Florida. Tom has seen him a few times down in Florida. But, you know, Greg Lake, you know, he's got Lucky Man. He's got some of those hit singles. And Keith Emerson, while it's not Rolling Stones money, but they could pay their bills with it, I'm sure, you know.
Right. So what does he play when he's out on tour? How does the show go?
What he's been doing the last 5-6 years, he's got a trio, but it's a bass player. And then as a guitar player, and the guy is just like crazy good doing the Keith Emerson keyboard parts on guitar. And it's not for everybody's taste. So when he has to do the Hammond stuff, he's distorted and everything. I think it's great. Sounds awesome.
Yeah.
And they're young guys that are with him. So.
And what's the name that he goes under? What's the?
Carl Palmer.
That's it.
And I think this tour, it's called Welcome Back, My Friends, to the Show That Never Ends, the music of ELP, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
So, okay. Yeah. But, you know, so, he's 70 something. He's getting up there and he's still drumming every night. It's amazing. Yeah.
I was going to say, I guess just like anything, through attrition, eventually fans just start to fall off as they get deeper and deeper into the history of rock and roll. You know, yeah. As time moves forward, they kind of, they don't move backwards, but they're not one of those bands that steadily progresses, right?
No, Emerson, Lake and Palmer. In fact, I would say their artistic peak was Brain Cell Surgery in 1973, and a lot of people would agree, but their fans are loyal. I would go see them. If they were still, all three of them still alive, and they were playing in Connecticut next week, I'd be up there. I'd be seeing them. So,
look, yeah, and Carl's in an auditorium.
Yeah, and Carl's day job until John went and died is he was also playing with Asia, and they toured right up until John died. So, yeah, so he had that going, too.
Yeah, yeah. All right, interesting. And what else did you guys talk about on the Music Relish podcast?
Oh, Lou had a great one-hit wonder. It was the Standells. Bam, 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 bam. Remember that song? It's a guitar opens it up. I'm a horrible singer, but the Standells, and we went over Standells, the history.
Dirty Water, right?
Dirty Water. There you go.
Yeah.
What's cool about these one-hit bands?
Bam, 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 bam. Growing up in Boston, I mean that is the,
yeah,
the, you know. My buddy Sean from Restream. Hey, listen, if anybody out there, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mark. If anybody out there does a podcast, does a live stream, and they do it remote with maybe someone from another town, another city, another state, another part of the world, Restream is the way to go. These guys are fantastic. And I'm not just saying this. Their customer service, I had a little glitch for the last month, like I said at the beginning of the podcast. I was on the help desk with somebody for at least an hour and a half. They did everything possible, and they didn't leave me hanging. They did not leave me hanging. They basically said, we're going to get Sean. And Sean's evidently a bigwig. He's one of the bigwigs. He actually did a face-to-face with me through Google. And listen, they helped me out immensely. I can't recommend them enough. If you're doing a video, if you're on one of those other video platforms, dump them. I'm telling you, Restream is, it's almost perfect. Nothing is perfect, but Restream, for what I need, what I do, what you need, what you do, as far as live streams and podcasts, they're the ones for you. I'm telling you, give them a try. And that's not a plug because Sean's watching. That's the truth.
Oh, no, you were talking to me before the show about them.
See?
Yeah.
See?
What did I say? I said, nothing's perfect, especially in digital. Things happen. It's how they help you. And they help. That speaks volumes. Yeah.
They have never let me down. They have never let me down. Am I sponsored by Restream? I wish I was sponsored by Restream.
Sean got me. Wait, hold on.
Elbow cough.
No. I work in a hospital.
Yeah, there you go. And see, Restream offers that. They can let you mute your mic. Watch, as I'm talking. And I know people like it when I mute myself, but hey, they give you that option. They give you that option. It's good. It's a good on the fly program, streaming program. So yeah, that's my kick for Restream. That's my push. That's my plug. And they're the real deal. And Sean, thank you and your team. I appreciate all the things you do for us people that use this wonderful product. So yeah, Sean just said, have a great stream. Let us know if we can help. And I told you, Mark, Sean would be watching. I said, he said he's going to be there, and he was there. Thank you very much, Sean. Thanks,
Sean.
Tell your team I said thank you also. All right. On with the show. So you guys talked a little bit about the concert for Taylor Hawk. Oh, for the Standells. Oh, yeah. But then we went on to.
Yeah, well, I was saying about when we do these one-hit wonders, you look at the history of these bands, and that's where we have really interesting conversations. Like, all right, these guys had one hit, but some of them have quite a history. So, and they're still together. They're still playing. Go figure.
Yeah.
After all those years.
One hit wonders. You know, what amazes me about some of these one hit wonders is like Tony Basil. Okay. Tony Basil. We all know who you grew up in the 80s or, you know, on the fringe of the 80s. You know who Tony Basil is. Right. She'd been around for a while before that, choreographer, etc. Did you know she has a greatest hits album?
No.
Yes, she does. She has a greatest hits, and it's not eight versions of Oh Mickey.
Is it called Take the Mickey Out of You?
It's not. There's no remixes. None of that. None of that. She has a greatest hits album. And there's one hit wonders that actually, I don't know how they got a record company to do that. It takes a little money, doesn't it?
Probably just enough interest in those other songs, right? You know, and then repack it, and then a whole new generation discovers Mickey.
Or maybe they're just banking on the fact that, like her first and I think evidently not only album, Mickey carried that whole album. You know,
Chubby Checker did about 20 different twists.
But that was brilliant marketing. They were different dances. When you strike that vein, buddy.
Yeah.
You keep digging into that vein.
And right? He owns his own publishing. Smart guy.
There you go. There you go. So you guys talked about the tribute concert.
Yeah. Yeah. We were touching on some of the high points. It sounds like I did not see it. So I'm going to put it. It's on Paramount. So one of these days, probably this weekend, I'll sit back and watch all 6 hours.
Yeah,
it sounded pretty good.
So I didn't see the whole thing myself. I'm having my kitchen it was demolished and it's being totally remodeled. So kind of been hectic in my house for a little bit. But at the beginning of the show, the Foo Fighters come out and Dave Grohl, you know, thank you. And he says a little speech and then he says, are you guys ready? Because this is going to be a long fucking show. And it was long. Yeah. It was definitely long. Put together very well. But I love the fact that right off the bat, he says, now let me bring on Liam Gallagher from Oasis. I thought that was cool, which is funny because I read something recently about Liam Gallagher. He just has to come over here, man. He doesn't seem to tour the States. He tours Europe a lot. Fucking big, right? But he just hasn't seemed to come over here too much. And he said Dave Grohl wrote one of the songs for him, and he played the drums on it, on his new album. And unfortunately, they weren't in the studio at the same time. They didn't play together, but you know how the recording goes now.
Yeah.
And the interviewer asked him, said, you know, what was it about, you know, Dave Grohl's song? He goes, well, he's got that rock and roll stuff, and he's a rock and roll guy, da, da, da. And he says, unlike his drummer, who sends me a fucking song a week, Taylor Hawkins.
Oh, yeah.
I think they were friends. He goes, he sends me a song a week, this guy. Like, you know, after a while, and he was laughing, you know. But he takes Dave Grohl's song because Dave Grohl's a better songwriter than Taylor Hawkins was. Taylor Hawkins was probably a better drummer.
Yeah.
Probably.
Absolutely.
Dave Grohl is a hell of a drummer.
Yeah.
So Liam Gallagher, who Dave Grohl referred to as one of the last real rock stars. And if you think about it, it makes sense. He is.
Yeah.
He's legitimately a rock star.
He's the ambassador for rock and roll. So you got certain people from each genre of music that show up at all the award shows. If you have an R&B awards show, Dave Grohl's there. If you have country music awards, Dave, he's the rock guy. He's the ambassador. And it's true. I mean, he's everyone knows him.
He's the one that he called Liam Gallagher one of the last true rock stars.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Dave Grohl is everywhere. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. And listen, he's business savvy. He loves what he does. It's his life. And why not? Guy's worth, last time I checked, $250 million.
Jeez.
You know, so you can do those things. Mm-hmm. You can do those things. But he said that Liam Gallagher is one of the last real rock stars. Just remember, I think Oasis came out in the 90s, right?
Yep.
As did Nirvana. So they kind of broke different times. I think Oasis came a couple years later, you know. But yeah, they had their thing over in England with Blur, you know, the Battle of the Brit Pops.
Oh, yeah.
That was big.
That was big. So my son-in-law is from England, and he told me about that whole thing. You had to pick your sides when you were a fan. But oddly,
did he say who he liked?
Both, but Oasis. He gravitates towards Oasis. But he taught me a lot about Blur. I didn't know a lot about him.
Yeah.
And I didn't know the Gorillaz came out of the Blur and all that. I didn't know any of that.
Yeah.
He saw, oddly enough, about 6 or 7 years ago, Liam Gallagher played in Central Park with Richard Branson from the Verve. And it was a co-headlining show. And he said it was fantastic. Free show, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oddly enough, Gorillaz was... they were invented... Well, it's hard to say. But Damon Albarn we're kind of going off subject here. And Jamie Hewitts, I think, who did Tank Girl, the comic book Tank Girl. They were just hanging out one night, and they started kind of just riffing about creating a cartoon band. And Jamie Hewitt just started drawing these characters, and Damon Albarn just jumped in. And next thing you know, they're writing songs for these characters. They're in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most records sold by an animated group.
Really?
Yeah. Ah. Yeah. Damon Albarn and the brothers, the Gallagher brothers, mostly Noel, did not like each other. They fucking hated each other. But as they got older, actually, Liam Gallagher has the High Flying Birds. He's had Damon come out and sing with them. Like, they're friends now.
Okay.
Like, we're too old for this shit. It was fun while it lasted, you know. And they created a lot of attention. They both made a lot of money doing it. But it was either Blur or Oasis. That was it. That was a marketing. It had to be somewhat planned between the two camps. Had to be.
Were they from the same city in England?
Oasis is from Manchester. I don't know if Blur, I don't think Blur is from Manchester.
Okay.
You know what? While I'm here, let me see. Blur.
Group. That would be real personal if they're both from Manchester.
Formed in London. So there you go.
Okay.
London and Manchester is New York City and Idaho or Pittsburgh. You know, one of those real
working
class city, Manchester. Mm-hmm. So he came out and did Rock and Roll Star and Live Forever, which was great with the Foo Fighters.
Those are great two songs to do.
Yeah, yeah. And Live Forever, as I watched it, I kind of, I don't know. As I get older, I don't like it when everybody starts singing. Because, I don't know. I just
Well, did Liam stop singing and let them sing? Okay, good.
And that's another thing. Back in the day, as I pick up my water bottle, I hold it out in front of me like a microphone pointed toward the crowd. That was your cue to sing, people.
Yeah.
This is a generation that came along just decided they were going to be one big karaoke at a concert. I hate that.
Well, I always hated when a singer would let the crowd carry the whole song. That's happened a few times, too, when I've seen concerts. Rod Stewart, the whole... Sailing, come on, sing it. The crowd doesn't want to sing it. You sing it.
Yeah. Well, I guess you could say, though, it's a good escape because sometimes these motherfuckers don't want to play that shit anymore.
That's true.
They don't. Michael McDonald, What a Fool Believes. I think it was What a Fool Believes. He let the backup singers kind of sing it. Like, and it was kind of odd when I saw him. If it wasn't that, it was another one of his popular songs. Maybe I keep forgetting. I don't know. But it was something that you're waiting for him to sing it, and he let backup singers sing. Jesus. Anyways. So I have a couple of highlights. I have a few highlights that I found pretty cool from what I saw. And I went and checked out some videos too. Wolfie Van Halen. I'll tell you what, man. The fucking kid, he got my respect. I was kind of apprehensive, you know, rock star's son, and, you know, get all the money in the world. And I know he played bass guitar, and he filled in for Michael Anthony, I guess, one tour. But he came out with Justin Hawkins, the singer from Darkness. And he did, came out with his father, one of his father's guitars. He played On Fire and Hot for Teacher. And I'll tell you what, this fucking kid shredded.
That's what I heard.
Like, shredded that shit. Like, what the fuck, Wolfie? I thought you were a bass player.
I heard that people were thinking that he was playing to a backing track of Eddie. But that guy, Rick Beato on YouTube, came to his defense and said, no, you will understand. Way. He was playing guitar with his dad since the age of six, I think. Yeah.
He was probably playing the guitar, but picked up the bass because his dad said, hey, you want to come out? Michael Anthony's gone. He's hanging with Sammy Hagar. Fuck them. Why don't you come out and play bass?
Yeah.
It's in the genes, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That guitar, actually, that he was playing, it's a new Eddie Van Halen Wolfgang model or something. It's like
is it, it's with coming the tiger stripe on it?
It looks really like, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I appreciate about him is that we all saw he could play like that, but he didn't, like, when he did his own music, he didn't do an album full of that type of stuff. So he's not ripping off his dad trying to just write his coattails. And I appreciate it. He's a real musician.
Yeah. Yeah. He came out, he played two guitars. One of them was like probably the one you just mentioned. It's really sleek. I call it that tiger stripe look.
Yeah.
Dark and lighter orange colors, stripes. And then he played, it was kind of a beat up guitar, you know, so it was probably something that just his guitar, right?
Yeah.
Stevie Ray used to do that. Stevie Ray played that Fender Strat that he never fixed. Like, I think it was just worn.
That was the electric equivalent of Willie Nelson's guitar. Yeah.
Yeah. That's yeah.
No holes in it. I saw that from third row. I saw him in a small gymnasium, Stevie Ray Vaughan. That guitar was beaten, but it's so that's what makes Strats great. You can beat a Strat and it'll come back.
I love the fact that he had those fucking those lettering, the polished SRV on there. It's like that cheesy shit that you would put on like the back of your Camaro, like your 78 Camaro. You put it on the back window, you know? He just didn't care. He's like, this is I forget what he named it. Like Jimmy or something like that.
And the hat with the feather. I love that.
You want about him, buddy. Do another show on him. So, yeah, and the guy Justin Hawkins from Darkness, or as they say in the Midwest, Darkness. See, I can say my R's, but I have to do it with a Southern accent. Darkness.
Well, I'm from Jersey, so it's Darkness.
Yeah, it's Darkness. I say Darkness. Darkness. The Darkness. He did a good job. Mm. He did a good job singing those songs. I don't follow them too much.
I'm surprised they're still together because they were kind of like that song they had that was popular. It was just kind of a rip on the 80s metal. You know, it was like a parody.
Yeah. It's a good song though, but it's that you know, they hits all those. What is that song? It's actually not a bad song, but
no, it's not. It's catchy.
They evidently had have a following, you know, so you know, keep doing it. So, so Wolfie just tore it up, did a great job. Then Rush came on and Dave Grohl took the place behind the drums. And, evidently, Taylor Hawkins had played, he'd got up on stage with them in Montreal. One concert and played a song or two with them. And Dave Grohl had stated that not only was it probably one of the greatest nights Taylor Hawkins ever had, but Dave Grohl said it was one of the greatest nights I ever had watching him play with Rush. You know,
I
mean, this kid, he's a, you know, to me pretty much, but mean, he lived his fantasies.
Yeah.
You know, he got to meet all his rock gods and play with them. And, you know, he was always just a really kind of a cool cat, right?
Yeah.
And well-liked by everybody. It, just looking at him, you know, like, how could he be an asshole? He just can't be. You know, yeah. They say don't judge a book by its cover, but you can tell Taylor Hawkins was just a nice fucking dude.
Yeah, just like you know? Dave. Just
Dave,
you know.
Grohl. Dave Grohl has his detractors.
Of course he does.
He does have his detractors.
But
you know?
Look at the, just a side note, look at all the people that came out to this concert. Oh, the rock royalty for, like you said, he's like a young kid to us. He wasn't young, but he was young, you know, yeah. To us.
I'm 58, so he was young to me.
Yeah.
You know,
it's just because he respected these people. He was cool. He was really a good guy.
So they played 2112 Part 1, the Part 1 Overture.
Overture, yeah.
And then they did Working Men. Mm-hmm. And those guys are just fucking autopilot.
They still got
every
it.
Every time, yeah.
Yeah.
Just fucking autopilot. They still look at, they still play good. You know, I think the way that they set themselves up, it was for longevity. Doesn't matter, like they, not like, you know, the young Van Halens, these young bands like Motley Crue did not set themselves up for longevity. You know, when they got old, they fucking looked old.
Yeah.
You know, when they put on weight, you noticed, you know, when they started losing their hair, you noticed. But Rush is one of those bands that were just built for longevity. They weren't focused on their looks and their look. They had to a certain extent. They are rock stars. But it's about the music with them. It's not about the stage performance. It's not about, okay, they had lights and the whole thing, but Rush was just built for longevity.
Don't get me started on Rush because I'll talk for 4 hours, but one thing, best friends, soulmates too. They were just right to the end, best of friends. They got along with each other. You don't see that in many bands.
Like U2.
Yeah.
U2, they've never even come close to breaking up. And if they did, we would have known.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think that they, the way they do it, just like Pearl Jam, besides the rotating or the revolving door of drummers coming in and out of Pearl Jam, I remember reading an article, like it's 15 years ago, and it was how when they tour, they're friends. They all get along. When they're in the studio, they're friends. But when they're not making an album or they're not touring, they have their own group of friends.
Yeah.
They don't stay with each other constantly. They figured out how to just make it work. You know, they lived in different places.
Yep.
They unwind, and then they get back together, and it keeps the machine moving.
Like Larry Mullen Jr.
Side projects. Yeah. Larry Mullen Jr. lived down in Miami. The Edge lived over in fucking Spain. Bono lived, I don't know, in a jet flying around the world saying, I'm Bono.
And appears in every rock documentary there is.
Yeah.
Every documentary.
And Adam Clayton is just like, I don't give a fuck. Talk about a guy who has the look of I don't give a fuck on his face. Just that smile, like I'm making so much fucking money right now. I don't even have to do an interview. Fuck the interviews. Fuck anything. Adam Clayton is just like, I'm just going to fucking play the guitar. I used to have an afro too. How's that, motherfuckers? I used to have an Irish afro.
And he gets one bass solo every, well, if they still play Gloria, he does that. Bop, bam. Hey,
the dude, wasn't the dude married to Iman? Or is he
really?
Still married to her? Yeah.
That was Bowie. Bowie married Iman.
No, then it was, who was it? I know Larry Mullen was with one of those long, lean models.
Yeah, would you be with her if he wasn't in U2?
Hey, that's, would Bowie be with Iman if he wasn't in, well, Bowie. Yeah, but so then they came out and they did their set and they just jammed, right?
And they did a warm-up gig. They did the South Park thing, so that was a little bit of a, did you see that?
No, I don't watch South Park.
They had their anniversary concert a few weeks ago, and Alex and Getty came out and everyone was saying that was just them warming up for the Taylor Hawkins thing, you know.
What is the thing with Alex Lifeson? That guy is like always the, like, he's not the brunt of jokes, but he's always mentioned as like, oh, Alex Lifeson. Like, I don't know if you ever watched Trailer Park Boys.
No.
Oh my God. If you've ever want to watch, it's the funniest Canadian show ever fucking made.
I'm right with that.
The first season's kind of slow, but it takes place in a trailer park in Vancouver. I believe it's Vancouver. It has to be because the weather's always nice. And it's like a reality show. Like this, it's like a documentary. It's almost like Reno 911. Like okay. The camera crew falls, except these three dudes live in a trailer park. And it's, I'm telling you, each season gets better and better and better. So if you've never watched Trailer Park Boys, I'm going to send you, how's this? After the show, I'll send you a YouTube clip of Rickyisms, and you'll get an idea of how it goes. But Alex Lifeson always seems to be like, there's something about him. I always think that it's not a joke, but he's mentioned a lot.
Well, listen, Alex is a nerd. He admits it. He was studying to be a scientist he's into, not studying, but he's into something, but he's a really smart guy, but he's got the funniest, best sense of humor. There's a documentary. There's a movie put out about Rush, which showed where they all grew up together. It's a great movie to watch. You actually see footage of Alex Lifeson telling his dad, I'm not going to college. I'm going to try and make this rock thing work. And his dad was a first generation immigrant from, I can't remember what country they were from. So you can see his dad wanted to kill him, you know?
Sounds like Sweden or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's something like, yeah.
Norway but or Sweden.
There's one quick scene where the three of them are in a restaurant and they love wine. They really love their wine. So it was kind of quick, the interview. They're sitting at the table, but Alex is joking. One of the extras on the DVD is they have like 15 minutes of that. So you see almost like the whole night in snippets. And they're mixing white wine, red wine, but Alex just goes off and Neil Peart gets the giggles. You ever get that where you just can't stop laughing? And just, you know, he's gone and Peart's just ready. His head's going to explode. You know, he's really a funny guy. That's probably the best image for me. Like these guys are really fun and they love hanging out with each other. So.
Right. And again, longevity, that helps.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the type of music that they played and they transformed. You know, they kind of progressed prog rock, but they progressed. They read the signs along the way.
Oh God, in high school, that was the argument. You had the 80s Rush fans. I was one of them. And you had, no, the 70s, the 70s. Right. I got tired of the 70s stuff. I like the 80s stuff beyond.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. From 2112 to, I don't know. Give me an album.
Hemispheres. That was their
Hemispheres,
big.
Yeah. That's right.
Then they went into Spirit of the Radio and they got, you know, and that's what 80 to 90. That was my favorite period. I saw almost every tour, but I missed the last tour. I couldn't go. Kicking myself.
I've never seen them. It's one of the bands that I've kind of, I had a chance to go see Bruce Springsteen down here in Hollywood. I have no desire. Not at this point.
Okay, that made me a fan seeing him. I hated him, and then I saw him live, and I became big fan.
Dude, at dinner the other night, this guy, Dr. Perman, he knows a lot. He knows a lot of musicians, and there's a picture of a selfie of his wife. It must have been at some sort of show or something. And he holds his phone up and he goes, "Real quick, who's that?" And I looked. I said, "Not Woody Allen, it's Bruce Springsteen." He has on these fucking glasses and he's kind of looking up at the camera. He goes, "That's Bruce." And I looked, I went, "Holy fuck, it is Bruce Springsteen. He looks like Woody Allen." He goes, "Yeah, yeah. His stylist definitely didn't do him any justice." Looks like Woody Allen with the,
What is that they say? Don't want to meet your heroes. You may not like what you see.
We've said that a couple times in the last month on this show. Yeah. Yeah. So then they came out. It was before I get to the last song, Dave Grohl's daughter, Violet Grohl, is fucking amazingly talented. As far as singing, this girl has the fucking voice of an angel. Go check her out. Go check out video. She sang two songs. She sang two Jeff Buckley songs. Oh. And her voice is, I went down a little rabbit hole on YouTube, and there's a video of her when she was like, I don't know, she's 16 here, so this was like when she was 14. He brings her on to on stage a couple years ago. She looks totally different. She looks like a 13, 14-year-old girl, right? Mm-hmm. And she's kind of awkward. And Dave Grohl starts telling the story about how, like, he said, we're going to do an Adele song. Oh, no, he asked her, what's the song we're doing? She goes, oh, it's When We Were Young or something by Adele. He goes, oh, yeah, Adele. He says, we did this at her talent show. Okay, first of all, imagine going to your fucking school's talent show to see a kid, and Dave Grohl rocks on stage with his daughter. It's playing guitar, like acoustic guitar with his daughter. Like, that's a free fucking concert.
Right?
So, on the video on YouTube, the girl, like, and he said at one point, he said, she has said to me that, no, I've been told by my family, I don't even have the best voice in the family, right? And she comes on stage and he's like, yeah, so you guys said, she's like, no, he looked at it and says, you told me that. You were the one that said, I don't even have the best voice in the family. So she starts laughing. And she starts singing this song, dude. It's fucking amazing how good this girl sings. Mm. Like, I was thinking, if she was ever just an average girl and went on America's Got Talent or something, the girl would go far. She's just has that great of a voice. And she got out there, and she sang those two Jeff Buckley songs at two different points in the show. But just very impressed with how she carries herself. I guess when Dave Grohl's your dad, you get used to being in front of 30,000 people, I guess. Wembley Stadium. Yeah, however many they are. What's that, 50?
Oh, 60, Dad, 70? You're only having me out at the Garden? There's only 20,000 people there.
Yeah, come on. Why you do this to me? You're so cheap, Dad. But if you get a chance to go check out a video by her, Violet Grohl, and she's just, the girl's got a future. If she wants one, she probably doesn't need one. But I'll tell you who has a fucking future. And this is the last one I have for my high points. I'm sure there's others, but so they got up there and they're going to do the last song. And he says, we have another drummer coming out to do this last song, and it's only fitting, and he's part of the family, and they bring out Taylor Hawkins' son, Shane, to play the drums, right? Kid's 16 years old, another 16-year-old kid. He gets up there, and they play There Goes My Hero.
Okay. Oh, this is during the Foo Fighters set.
During the Foo Fighters. Yeah, I'm sorry. I kind of jumping around. Yeah, so...
Yeah.
This is at the show, at the concert for Taylor Hawkins. The Foo Fighters are playing. They're going to finish the show. They're going to finish the night. And they bring him out to play drums with them. And I'll tell you, Dave Grohl said, I don't think I've ever seen anybody hit drums harder than this kid. And this kid does whack those drums, man.
Oh, he's going to be in his father's footsteps. Drums. Yeah.
And, he's probably going to be better than his father. Because this kid is polished at 16. Like, he's polished, right? Like, I'm thinking to myself, he gets another couple years under his belt, and he might be touring with the Foo Fighters. He might be their drummer. He's that good, you know? And he's confident, and he has a little swag. Like, he has a little smile, and he's not, like, shy, you know? And this kid just fucking busted it out. And that's a good drummer's song.
And, you know, Dave's looking at that going,
Oh, maybe. I think they already knew. I think they already...
I mean, like, putting them in the band. I think it's
that's what I mean. I think they might... And he probably will tell the kid, it's up to you. You know, get another couple years under your belt. You know, we are one of the biggest bands in the world. We can't just have a drummer, you know? So, but the kid proved himself. I guess it's the equivalent of Clarence Clemens' nephew playing with the E Street Band.
Right.
They weren't just going to let any fucking saxophone player come in. You know, you get some big fucking shoes to fill. And this kid, I think this kid could do it. If not, he's going to be in a rock band somewhere. You know, going to be in a rock band somewhere. And when you got Dave Grohl as your pseudo uncle, oh, you're fucked. The kid's got a future. Absolutely no doubt. Absolutely no doubt.
Uncle Dave, can I play?
They won't let me play in their band. What's the fucking number? You let him play. You hear me? Wait, I will
That's Paul McCartney? I'll call him right now. You're in that band. That
little piece of shit. I'll get you in his band. I'm Dave Grohl, damn it. So that was pretty. Those were some pretty good highlights from that 6-hour concert.
Yeah. Well, one thing about the Geddy and Alex was Dave Grohl played drums for two of the songs, but then even he knew when they did YYZ, he left the drum kit, he played bass. No, he didn't play bass. I'm sorry. But they got this guy, Omar Hakim. Do you know who he is?
No.
He played for David Bowie, and he also played in many jazz and fusion. He's one of the best drummers in the world, so he played YYZ. I got to see that.
Okay.
What the two things about this concert that I want to see is Stuart Copeland. He played with the Foo Fighters, and he did Next to You, and Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic. And, of course, Dave Grohl sang Next to You. And then the other one I want to see, and it could be a disaster, is you know that singer Josh Homme? He's got Queens of the New Stone Age.
Queens of the Stone Age, yeah.
Okay. So he came out with Nile Rodgers, remember from Chic? And Omar Hakim, and they played both of them because Nile Rodgers produced David Bowie's Let's Dance.
Yeah.
So they played Let's Dance with Josh Homme singing. That could be a disaster or it could work. I just don't know how that would sound.
Check that out. Yeah.
And then they did Modern Love, but Josh didn't sing that. I want to see the whole thing. It's really neat. Again, it was like that Freddie Mercury tribute concert, which was an all-day thing, and that was fantastic. I remember seeing Tony Iommi from Black Sabbath playing rhythm guitar for Brian May, and I'm like, it was just blowing my mind. There's Tony Iommi in his black, you know, playing Queen songs, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I wonder, they did something for Taylor Hawkins. Why wasn't there anything done for Eddie Van Halen? Arguably the greatest guitar player of all time.
Could have been Eddie's wishes. He had a long time to think about this. We don't know what he told the family. There was talk of Van Halen touring.
Freddie Mercury had a little bit of time.
Yeah.
But, I mean, different people, different minds.
Eddie is a tribute, though.
A tribute's a tribute. I look at it like it's an honor to have people. Like the one, like George Harrison, they had that thing for him, you know.
Yeah. And,
I just think, I don't know.
I think Eddie's just so private. I think he said, I don't want to make a big deal about this. That's my feeling on it. Freddie, on the other hand, probably said, I want the most beautiful party in the world.
Yeah. Well, maybe Alex said, I don't even want to take the chance of fucking David Lee Roth and Sammy Hagar playing at my fucking tribute concert. Although Sammy Hagar did say that they did mend their differences in the end. They did a lot of texting, he said, because Eddie couldn't talk. But he said, we did a lot of texting back and forth, and we really kind of, we fixed a lot of the problems. We kind of came to, you know.
Sammy's a good guy. I mean, I read his autobiography, and when he wrote it, he was in still bad terms with Eddie, and he goes over that last tour he did where Eddie was just drinking his face off and
his tongue.
He said that last tour, he said when Eddie had the hair in a certain style, you knew he was mad drunk, angry. And he did most of the tours like that. But through all his anger at Eddie, there was some kind of, you could see like it was a love coming through. Like he was just disappointed. Van Halen basically just fell apart, you know, and they could have done so much more. And so I knew they would patch up.
So there was one very uncomfortable set that I watched. It was just, I don't know. It was kind of awkward. It wasn't really well done. They brought out Brian Johnson, right, from AC/DC. And it wasn't really that good.
Was he right on the mic?
don't like that.
You know, and listen, I'm not dogging Brian. Brian Johnson is a fucking rock god. There's no doubt about it. I mean, the guy filled some gigantic shoes and kept them filled and then made his own shoes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He put those shoes away, made his own shoes, and his shoes were bigger. Mm-hmm. They were bigger. But who wouldn't? The Bon Scott, I think, would have been really hard to. If he had a little more time, that dude would have just, I don't know, he would have kept going higher and higher.
That's my personal favorite. There's, you know, two camps, right? Do you like Brian or Bon? Bon. But yeah, no, Bon's Brian. Brian became a rock god.
He did.
Brian Johnson.
He wasn't a rock god. Bon Scott had the swagger. Bon Scott had the attitude. He had the fuck you. I really don't give a fuck. I'm a rock star, and I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want attitude. That snarly, you know. And Brian Johnson was just a nice dude. Mm-hmm. You know, had a very heavy voice and just a beer drinking, you know, whiskey drinking, like a buddy. You know what I mean? Like a buddy. Bon Scott was kind of like that dude that just got out of fucking prison and you don't know like what he's going to do from minute to minute. You know? Fucking wild cards, I think, you know, who's always those people that, believe it or not, are fun to be around.
Yeah.
Cause it keeps things interesting,
but you got to watch every minute. You got to watch what's going on. Cause you might got to get out of there.
You got to be ready for something. Just be ready. You know?
Yeah.
Don't let your guard down. Have fun, but don't let your guard down.
By the way, I like how Brian Johnson says AC/DC. I say, they say. I can't even do it the way he does.
Yeah. Yeah. And he came out and sang Back in Black, right? And it was kind of strange because at one point, Justin Hawkins from Darkness just kind of comes on the stage. Like, he just shows up, right? He doesn't really know, but he walks right up to Brian Johnson and you're kind of watching this, like, what the fuck's, like, what is this? And Brian Johnson hands him the mic for the second verse and doesn't know, like, the words. Doesn't really, and it's kind of like, what the fuck's going on? It's very awkward, right?
What song were they doing?
It was Back in Black.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
So, after the show, somebody, evidently how it goes, somebody tweeted, like, they should have, kicked his ass off the stage and kicked him out of the stadium for a stunt like that, you know.
That is disrespectful to do that to someone. But
there's more to the story. There's the rest of the story. So someone responded that Brian Johnson had called him onto the stage, right? So now there's this like in the Twitterverse, which is a little fucking a lot dysfunctional. Anyways. Justin Hawkins chimes in. He says, 10 seconds before AC/DC goes on stage, or before the AC/DC section, Brian told me to get up for the second verse of Back in Black. I didn't want to do it. I never sung that before. That's what happened, right? But Dave Grohl said to him, and I quote, if Brian tells you to do something, you fucking do it.
That's right.
Right? So... And then Wolfgang Van Halen chimes in, you're goddamn right. So this dude's getting fucked up from Dave Grohl and Wolfie Van Halen, right? And he's got to come on stage to this huge event, and he doesn't know the fucking words to the song. How uncomfortable did he feel?
And he doesn't have the voice for it either. I mean...
No. He has
that. Also, now I feel bad. He must have been shitting bricks, you know?
You watch the video. You got to watch it. And it just looks so fucking awkward, right? And you don't, as a viewer, you really didn't know what the fuck was going on. It's like, why did he just walks on the stage? Who the fuck's this guy? How dare you? Like, how dare you walk on the stage with the Foo Fighters and Brian Johnson? Like, come on. That's the story. That's the rest of the story.
Just told me to come on.
And now, what was the fucking conversation between those two where Brian Johnson just says, all right, just come on during the second verse, all right? I got you covered. And he fucking just hands on the mic. And he's... it kind of went like that for a second.
I think Brian Johnson went in his ear and went,
I gotta come on stage, okay?
give his voice a rest. I think that's what he really wanted.
Yeah.
Was to give his voice a little bit of a rest, because he's getting to that point, man, where he can't carry that. He can't carry it anymore.
Fooling around, you go to a party and you do the Brian Johnson, right?
You're
coughing in
about 60 seconds.
Can you imagine what his vocal cords look like? Barbed wire. You know?
Dave Grohl blows his voice out constantly. You can only imagine what his looked like. But Brian Johnson's? Yeah, it looks like fucking, like, what is it? 39 grade sandpaper, whatever the fuck shit is.
And he smokes. I think he still smokes.
And he drinks whiskey.
Well, that helps him.
He's a rock god, right? He's a fucking rock god.
He doesn't drink Chardonnay, though.
Yeah. You're doing good tonight. You just got a quarter of it done?
Always with you, Scott. I know. I do one glass the whole show. The thing is, it's filled up to here at the start.
I saw that. That is not a regular glass of wine. That is a full tank of wine.
You'll never get that pour in an Applebee's or a Chili's.
You're going to buy the bottle for that shit. My take on the Taylor Hawkins tribute concert. It was well done. They did a fucking great job of getting all these people to come in and getting all the music right. And it shows the talent that, like, Dave Grohl has, where he can sit in on with Rush and he can sit in with this group and that group. And I've said it before and I'll say it again, but that just goes to show you how talented Kurt Cobain is when Dave Grohl is your drummer, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the guy is a genius, a musical genius and producer. The guy just has it all. But those are the highlights and the low light.
You remember when that first Foo Fighters came out? We all do. And Dave Grohl from you know, the drummer, And I listened to it, and then someone, he played all the instruments. So I'm like, wow, he's good. Like, he's really good. It was almost like a George Harrison doing All Things Must Pass after the Beatles broke up, you know? And, love him or hate him. A lot of people hate the Foo Fighters, but they've been putting out quality music. I like them.
Do you know what their most popular song is?
Everlong?
Yep.
And I think Howard Stern had a big part of that. So remember, he was on and he did the acoustic version?
There's a couple of versions of that, I think, on Howard Stern.
It's not him, but yeah, it's a great song.
No, like, I think he's on a couple. I know that there's a couple of versions. I know he did Everlong a little slower on one time. I think he came on more than a couple times onto the Stern show. And I remember hearing it on when I used to rape Napster. Oh, I used to rape. Well, Napster was giving me the tools.
Did Lars sue you? Lars Ulrich?
No. But I remember people started renaming files like RATM, right? It would say RATM, and then it would say like 001, and RATM was Rage Against the Machine. You hear it, you're like, so the file wouldn't get flagged because it says Rage Against the Machine, and
right.
But I'm not shy to say I got 10,000 MP3s out of them. Then I always tell the story. Long story short, I went to this record store in Hollywood, Florida, when I first moved down here, called Coconuts, and I went to buy the Clash London Calling CD, and that was $24. And I said, whoa, this thing came out. It's made its money three times. It's 23 years old. It's made its money three times. You're trying to charge me $24 for this thing?
Yeah. Coconuts and Sam Goody. Did you ever have Sam Goody's up in Boston when you were growing up?
No.
All right. So we had one Coconuts in New Jersey, but Sam Goody was all over. Same thing. You know, every CD was like $16 to $24, but you go to your local CD record store and the CDs would be $10-$12, you know?
Yeah.
What a ripoff.
Yeah. We had Strawberries in Boston. Jack used to work there. It was a big record store.
Yeah.
And they ended up having a second. They bought like the whole building and they had a second floor and a third floor. And they had the old school elevator with the screen. You pull the screen and like,
oh, cool.
if the elevator guy, Jack, I guess at some point was the elevator guy, like he'd go just a little lower than the floor. So you have to step up into the, you know, it was one of those, like you had to have really good timing and,
who's going to trip today.
Yeah. Yeah. But that was the beginning of me saying, you know what, this is, this ain't right. Because what these people are doing, these record companies are doing it, were doing where they were taking advantage of the vinyl generation.
Yep.
And they're like, oh, all these people are going to want to replace their vinyl records with CDs now. Like, and it was kind of a thing. Like, you were going to go get the Clash, right? Because you can't play the album anymore because you don't have a turntable and speakers. And I just said, no. That and I had bought CDs prior to that. I probably had a good, and a lot of them were new, like Silverchair, and I had, you know, like Rob Zombie and Marilyn Manson and Rage Against the Machine, and I had, you know, I had some older ones that I purchased, and I just said, you know what, I gave them my money.
Yeah,
you know, and you're not going to get me twice like that. If it was like $14, and it stayed reasonable, I would have had no problem with that.
Yeah.
But I knew they were price gouging.
Oh, yeah. And I think that started a whole generation of people downloading files. And the ironic thing is that first issue of their CD of London Calling was made from a quarter-inch production master. You could buy that CD now. In fact, I ordered it from Amazon for $12, and it's been redone from the original master tapes. It sounds 10 times better.
Right.
The record companies just couldn't get away with that for years. They tried. They tried to put out crappy sounding CDs, and people realized it after a while.
So that's the shit I bring you on the show for. For that shit right there. Those
it gets me mad.
Tidbits. Those little fucking behind the scenes tidbits. Yeah. That's why you're on this show.
Nothing gets me more mad than somebody trying to make money off inferior product and music, because it just ruins the whole industry, you know?
So let me ask you this. When I was in my my Isuzu Amigo, which don't laugh, I love that little fucking, that thing could kick up some dirt, man. It was a tin can on four wheels, but that thing was fun, right? It was bigger than a Samurai. It was bigger than the Geo? Remember the Geo, I think, or something? It was like those, it was like a Samurai, but the Isuzu Amigo was a little wider, a little longer. There was a lot of room in the back for someone sitting in the back, a lot of leg room.
They had serious kick, I think, right?
It was the thing was light. Like if I used to skip it on the dirt, the thing would like, it was only a four banger, but it's literally like a fucking tin can. There's no weight to it, right?
Yeah.
The frame was probably aluminum, for all I knew, right? But there it was fun. It was fun to drive. But what I did was, so on the side, if you're looking at the side of Amigo, you see the front fender. The driver's side door, and then just like a Samurai Suzuki, you had the back that would come off, right? So it was kind of a when you took it off, it was almost like a how can I put it? The back, it was like a rumble seat, right? So the back was open, but the roof just covered over to the over the front seat and the driver's seat, right? It was like a rumble seat in the back, so you had that kind of slant down, which left that between where the roof came off and the driver's side window, you had this kind of flat area. So what I did was I had some, I brought this to a, I brought the truck to a, not a stereo shop. I brought it to a body shop.
Okay.
One Saturday morning, I was in Sacramento, and I bought some good old school Jensen coaxials.
Oh, right. Jensen's.
Right.
Good speakers.
I fucking love those things. And I told the guy, I said, I got in the inside. I said, can you, there was a little square. It was just a little square that was already open. I think it was for like if they wanted to put a speaker. I said, can you cut this open and put these speakers in there, like on each side? Guy goes, damn, I never get to do this shit. Sure. This guy put these fucking speakers in, right? And he sealed them. He sealed them in. Which made the truck now a bass box, right?
Yeah.
It all reverbed inside the truck, right? And then I got a because it was easy to break into, right? So I had to have the stereo with the face you could take off, right? But I got a toolbox, just a fucking red toolbox, and I screwed it to the back floor right by the tailgate. I had it screwed down, cut a hole in it, and put a six-pack CD player in there.
Nice.
Right? And ran the cords out the back. You couldn't really see it. It went under the seat, under all the way to the stereo in front. So I had a six-pack CD. No, you try to take the shitty toolbox, it's stuck to the, you're just going to keep walking. Because I didn't always put the roof on that thing, right?
Yeah.
And when it rained, it's in the toolbox, you know? There was a towel in there, just in case.
The shitty toolbox.
That thing, fuck, I'll tell you what, man. I got pretty fucking ingenious with that stuff. Yeah, so I had that, and I would get these CDs, like, you know, Marilyn Manson, or, and they would just fucking crank. So my point to the story is, at a certain point, it gets so loud, I don't think you realize the shitty quality that you just bought in that CD.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
I agree.
You know?
And cars are not, that's not where you want a quality audio.
Although a lot of studios, what they would do is when they would, like these kind of, how can I say, like hood studios, like you'd go in, to, you'd rent something. Rent some time in a studio, and you'd cut a you would cut a CD out of whatever song you made. Yeah. They would go out to the car and listen to it in the car to see how it sounds.
Sure.
Because a lot of music was also made for cars.
Yeah.
Like, you could probably say, a lot of hip-hop was made for cars.
Sure.
For that sound in cars, that booming sound.
And when you had cassettes and CDs out at the same time, you mastered for each format. So a cassette, you just compressed it a hell of a lot more because tape, you know, you can't go too loud. It distorts. And definitely bass boost the bass as much as you can. But we had a lot of small-time rap artists come in, and they just wanted me to work for the cassette. You know, they already had their CD done, and they would have their car.
A four-track cassette?
Yeah. Well, we also had some of these when rap, like anything. Remember when rap hit big, you had a million rap labels. So we had this thing, Hot Records from Miami, Florida, owned by Henry Stone.
Hot Records. I've heard of them. Yeah.
Yeah. And, we were doing all their cassettes. Henry Stone, I think I've referenced it, that scene in Sopranos when Tony says to Hesh, "You're amazing. You've written more number one R&B songs than anyone I know." Because Henry Stone was like that. He put his name on every song. And these poor guys say, "I'm going to have a big rap career, you know." We got nowhere. Yeah. Some would sell. But, they come up, and sometimes if you let the artist come up, and, yeah, so it was – that introduced me to that, like, that whole thing. Like, I'm in the studio. Well, what you hear in the studio is nothing like in the car. No. Nothing at all. No. And Eddie Van Halen did that, too. He would take mixes for Van Halen. That's why their stuff always sounded great in the car.
Yeah, I used to this guy I worked with. He was Pro Tools certified, and I was into Ableton Live, you know. So we'd make beats, right? Okay. Make the beats through Ableton Live and put them into and mix them down on Pro Tools, and I still got a lot of like the files. This is we're going back 15 years, right? Yeah. But what we would do is we'd make the beats. And then we'd burn it on my iMac, mm-hmm. and then bring it right out to the car and pop it in and listen to it on the stereo. Because I had this, I had a 98 Explorer with 22-inch Dayton's rims.
Wow.
That were 24-karat gold spoked. There was 180 spokes in each one with Toyo tires. Dude, I had a system in that thing. It was I got to find a picture of this thing. It was a dunk. It was a donkey dunk.
You were Scott from the block.
Oh, buddy, I'll tell you what. Yeah, and I got those rims from my buddy who was he's a big Coke dealer. He's like, "Hey." I'm like, "Hey, what are you doing with those rims?" He goes, "No, like I say, look, I always say, I know a lot of good people, and I know a lot of good people that do bad things or did bad things. Doesn't make them bad people. And I know a lot of bad people.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot. I know enough bad people that did bad things. Right.
Yeah.
This dude was just a good person that was doing a bad thing. Right. And he's like, I don't know. I said, well, yeah. Now these are like, these Daytons are, like I said, 24 karat gold spokes, 180 spokes in each rim, 22 inch rims. So going back to the 2000s, right? The early 2000s, mid 2000s. And when it was the shit, it was Pimp My Ride and all that. And I think he sold them to me for like $1,000, like $250 each. They were actually $1,200 a piece.
Wow.
It's how much money the dude was rolling in.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And he let me make payments. He's a good drug dealer.
Yeah.
Let me make installments. And I put them on my Explorer. It's kind of cool looking, man. All I gotta say, it was kind of cool. Yeah, I had a subwoofer back there, like with three fucking 12s in it, and
wow,
that's a whole thing, and the amp and the whole thing. But anyway,
I take it you weren't playing Eric Clapton on your car.
That's No. Wasn't playing any of that.
And certain rap albums sounded phenomenal in cars, and one of them was the LL Cool J with Mama Said Knock You Out. I can't remember the name of the album. Is it Mama Said Knock You Out? Was like my favorite sounding rap album in a car. It just, the compression on the bass was perfect. When you played Around the Way Girl, that was just perfect. That's like everything in that. The recording, I think Rick Rubin may have done that album.
And that's those are those albums, those Def Jam records were done. Those CDs were done with that in mind. House parties and cars.
Yeah.
Clubs was not really what they were thinking about. You know, they were thinking home stereos and cars. And systems back then weren't as advanced as they are today. They were good.
Yeah.
You know, like Blaupunk was Blaupunk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had one of those that was someone stole and out of a Saab, and I had it in my 73 Plymouth Volare station wagon and a Blaupunk with some Jensens. And I had like the original subwoofer, dude. I had a Bose 301 in the back seat.
Oh, damn, Bose. The original subwoofer.
Yeah. I had that thing. I ran that speaker cord in and I hooked that shit up to the Blaupunk in my 73 Plymouth Volare station wagon it was white with the fake wood fucking on the side panel. And ski racks. Not the ski rack. It had the fucking roof rack.
Yeah.
But that shit had some fucking nice red leather interior. I'll tell you that. So no one was stealing my stereo. They looked at that car. They're like, there can't be shit in that motherfucker.
You want to hear my Jensen story?
Yeah.
You said the Jensens. They were good. I had my first car was a 79 Buick Skylark. And yellow. Banana yellow. So I get the Jensens.
Had a Skylark. My brother had a fucking yellow Skylark.
He might have bought.
I swear to God,
I sold mine.
Tan upstate. Roof, like it had like a dark tan roof or something.
Same car.
The fake leather, yeah.
Yeah. So I got Jensens, and me and a friend of mine, we spent the whole weekend. We cut the back, you know, behind the seat, the little roof there, you know, putting the Jensens behind the back seat, and we did a great job, and they sounded great. And then the last year of high school, senior year, Pink Floyd were playing at Nassau Coliseum in Long Island. And, of course, Mark's got a car. He can drive from New Jersey to Long Island. That's a long-ass drive. So we drove out. That was a concert that they videotaped and recorded for the Delicate Sound of Thunder. And we're in the show, and I'm seeing Pink Floyd. I'm like, this is great. We come out. I'm walking up to my car as we're walking, and I go, guys, did it rain? And they go, what do you mean? I says, my car's, like, wet. And they said, that's glass.
They got you.
Benched in the back window, took the speakers out, and got the stereo, my tape player and everything. So we drove from Nassau Coliseum. It was November, with the back window wide open, bringing all the exhaust in, going over the Cross Bronx and Expressway through the Bronx. Coldest night. Oh, man. So every time I hear Pink Floyd, I get a little, like, sad. You know?
Yeah. Fuckers. They got you.
At a Pink Floyd concert.
Right? Right? Fuckers. Fuckers. So, you know what? Talking about hip hop, right? I don't know. Were you listening to rap? Did you listen to rap in the 90s?
Well, I got into rap with like Public Enemy. That was
started really, in the 80s into the 90s.
Yeah. What? Actually, I heard rap. Oh God, 79. What was that big hit? Sugar Hill Records. Sugar Hill Gang. My sister she went to Rutgers University.
Everybody played that. Opened up my mind
so much music, and that was great. But yeah, when Public Enemy to me were the heavy metal of rap. They were just so good. Like, I loved it. Then in the 90s, I lost track with rap because like every kind of music, as it got popular, I felt it was getting watered down. It goes into a lot of things. I lost touch with a lot of stuff in the 90s. What I didn't realize until I went back years later was rap was just expanding. There was some bad rap, but there was different kinds of rap, and I missed a lot of it. There was jazzy rap, like Blue Note Records had some rap artists that were sampling jazz. I should have paid attention. I probably would have discovered a lot of good stuff.
The beauty of music is you can always go back and find it.
Yep, now, exactly.
The 90s was the golden age of rap. It was the golden age of rap. It had evolved. It had become more, started to become more polished.
Mm-hmm.
There was more technical aspects to it because the equipment started getting better. The recording studio started getting better. And they realized they were onto something. And you had this explosion of, you know, rap artists, rap groups, hip-hop artists, whatever you want to call them, that said, I can do that. I want to do that. I'm going to do that. So you had, it was almost like rap in the 90s, I equate to the British invasion, right?
Yeah.
Except it was within the United States. You just all of a sudden had this surge. And you had some older groups, but you had these other groups coming up in the 90s. Now I got a list of, and this is a hard list. This for me is a hard list to make. And these lists are always, always subjective. And they're always subject to change, right? Like, as I went through all these songs, I actually bumped some off. Like, I bumped off Jay-Z's Hard Knock Life, right? I give that a honorable mention because that was an absolute unique song. Yeah. Like, you sample from a fucking Broadway play, dude. So that's some brilliant shit right there.
Yeah.
And you make a fucking hit out of it, you know? So this isn't in any particular order, but these songs, along with the hip hop artists, 10 songs that I just look back and go, these defined hip hop. And I don't think it ever got better. I think this was the golden age, just like they say, the golden age of movies. But movies were just fucking good.
Yeah.
There was no pretentiousness. There was no... hip-hop is full of messages, but that's what it's about. So you understand that. So it doesn't really affect anything in the song.
Yeah.
Unless you're a fucking, you know, a metalhead. I have friends today that still refuse. Fuck that rap crap. Da-da-da. I'm like, dude, you're fucking 60 years old. You haven't evolved. You haven't even taken a chance to listen to something. You just hate it automatically.
As a Motorhead, Judas Priest, Iron Maiden fan,
yeah,
I got the same feeling from Public Enemy and NWA. That's what got me into rap. It was real. It wasn't fake. You know?
Right. And these were some fucking good, very talented artists and DJs. Now, back in the day when hip-hop kicked off, the DJ got all the credit. Eric B. in Rakim. You know, DJ Jazzy Jeff in The Fresh Prince.
Yeah.
Right? The DJ was the shit. And Eric B. will always be the shit, but Rakim is the god. To me, he is the rap god. No one's ever been as good since, and before or since. He's had a lot, and that's just, again, subjective. There's a lot of people that agree with me. That is a big kind of topic in the old school hip hop head world of who's the best MC. You know what I mean? And for those white guys out there and white girls that don't know what MC stands for, It's mic control. They control the mic. They get the mic control.
You just taught me something. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's what MC stands for.
I thought it was MC of ceremonies.
Not mic controller, right? Okay. Mic controller. So the first song, these aren't in any particular order. The first song stands out to me. Came out in 1991. Absolute unique sounding fucking band. Cypress Hill, the song is How I Could Just Kill a Man. Right?
Yeah.
But be real with that nasally, has that nasally sound. And he just and then you got Zen Dog with that deep voice. And the way they just go is fucking like this style is just kind of and DJ Muggs, who was actually produced all those songs. So DJ Muggs is making a lot of money. Has made a lot of money because Cypress Hill has sold millions and millions of albums, right? Mm-hmm. But Cypress Hill, How I Could Just Kill a Man, when I first heard that, that was one of those eye-openers. And I was into hip-hop, right? But I was listening, you know, Big Daddy Kane, Eric B. Rakim, LL Cool J, you know, you go down the road, Cool Mo D, you know, Fab Five Freddy, all the, well, he wasn't a rapper, but you know, you go down the line of all the old school hip hop guys, and then you hear this, and it's like this shit's different. But it was 91, so I always say decades, transitions, and decades are interesting. You get some. I was saying this the other night at dinner. There's songs that were made in 1965 that, if you listen to, you could say that was made in 1957. Because there's always that kind of residual.
Yes, but
this song was a standout. Then the next song came out in 1993 on the album Enter the Wu-Tang 36 Chambers, this which is one of the finest debut rap albums ever fucking released. And this song, C-R-E-A-M, Cream. You got Raekwon, Method Man, Inspector Deck, all doing their thing in there because the Wu-Tang is as unique as they come. But it's Cream. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar bill, y'all. And Method Man starts that off. And Cream, I heard that. Fucking, I got goosebumps from that. That song just, it's till this day. I got it as a ringtone. That's how fucking great that song is.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah, Cream by the Wu-Tang. Enter the Wu-Tang, 36 Chambers. That's the album. Came out in 93.
I'm writing all these down.
Yeah. I'll text them to you, too.
Yeah.
The third song on my list is Public Enemy, of course. Mm-hmm. Of course. From the album Fear of a Black Planet, 1990. The song, now that same album had Fight the Power on it, which is a pretty fucking big, so that's a pretty heavy song.
Yeah.
But Welcome to the Terror Dome is such a different sound. It's fucking fast and furious.
Yeah.
And it just keeps going. What's his name? Terminator X, the DJ. That dude was another. Just, that dude was as great. All these DJs. Although, that's the thing. Wu-Tang didn't really have a DJ. You know, they just did their thing. So Welcome to the Terror Dome, 1990, Public Enemy, Fear of a Black Planet. Then I kind of go in a different direction from 1991, Check the Rhyme by Tribe Called Quest, off of the Low End Theory, which is one of the most celebrated hip-hop albums in history. They were nominated. They were on the list. They didn't get nominated for the Rock Hall of Fame, because that's always, you know, it's a hard sell for rap artists, but they're in the conversation because Tribe Called Quest is, again, as unique as it gets.
Look, I'm going to say, in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, with a lot of the fluff that's being introduced,
yeah,
these rap artists have more of the spirit of rock and roll than a lot of this fluff that's going in. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And Q-Tip has another one of those unique voices. Check the Rhyme from Low End Theory, one of the greatest hip-hop albums ever. Then you got this motherfucker broke out when he left NWA and Ice Cube with the song Jackin' for Beats.
Yes.
Jackin' for Beats. I don't know if you've ever heard it. All right.
I've heard it in like 20-something years.
It was produced by Sir Jinx, and the song actually has samples from Call Me D-Nice by D-Nice, So What You Sayin' by EPMD, Welcome to the Terror Dome by Public Enemy, The Humpty Dance, Digital Underground, Big Old Butt by LL Cool J, Heed the Word from of the Brother from the X-Clan, right? And there was also a James Brown sample in there.
There's always a James Brown
sample. Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, because his shit was that funky. Yeah. That ahead of his time. So Ice Cube said that song, Jackin' for Beats, is probably the most expensive publishing song in rap history. He said they wanted 150% of publishing. He's like, how do you get 150% out of 100%? He said, when he heard that, he said to his producer, wait a minute, this song's actually costing me money to do? He said, that song became the reason why you don't sample as much anymore, why he didn't, and a lot of bands stopped sampling. It wasn't cost effective.
Now, what's unique is he was sampling other rap songs when rappers were mostly sampling older songs.
Great point. Yeah. He was sampling that because when they asked him, why'd you say it? He said, because all those songs are songs that I wanted to be on. They were all that good. I liked them so much, I wanted to be on them. So I said, fuck it. Let's put it all together. So Jackin' for Beats is a very unique rap song. And if you're a hip-hop head, old school hip-hop head, you'll know the samples that are in there. And you're like, damn. When you first hear it, you're like, how's he getting, he's not on Def Jam Records. How's he getting Public Enemy in that? Like, how's he called D-Nice? D-Nice is like, you know, he's kind of a one-hit wonder in a sense, Call Me D-Nice, which is a great song. But it's like, how'd you get all these in? But he did, and he paid for it.
He paid for it.
The sixth song that I'll mention, it's called Shook Ones, S-H-O-K-O-N-E-S, Part 2, by Mobb Deep, 1994. It's a fucking heavy song. That song actually kicked off the hip-hop scene, the renaissance of East Coast rap. Because East Coast rap started everything. West Coast really took the lead in all this shit. Mm-hmm. Like, they really busted out heavy. But Mobb Deep, when they came out with Shook Ones Part 2, that created a whole, that opened up the East Coast like, oh, shit, we're fucking back. And they kept coming. And then it slowly built into that East Coast, West Coast thing. But Shook Ones Part 2 by Mobb Deep, that's a heavy fucking song, man. Then the seventh song that I'm going to talk about, and I know probably at this point all my my middle-aged white friends are going, all right, I'm just gonna turn us off at this time. But you know what? There's some that are still listening, and they're the ones that matter.
It's music history. It's education.
That's right. Hip hop. I'm telling you, you know, hey, my brother came around and he's 61, 62. He came around about 8 years ago, like started listening from Public Enemy, loves Wu-Tang Clan, you know, and he was an Allman Brothers guy. So it shows it's never too late. And then this motherfucker called me up. He's like, I was listening to this shit. I said, you get the fuck out of here. I was telling you about this shit. You were telling me, yeah, go listen to the Allman Brothers. I'm like, you telling me you were listening? You weren't listening to this shit. I was telling you about it. Ah, you were not. I was listening. Like, he just can't admit that I was right. Typical older brother. Fucking can't admit it. Just, he'd lie right to my face. Lie right over the phone and say, nope, I was listening to it too. You fucking liar. I'm going to say it in front of the podcast world.
Uh-oh.
Colin McClain, one of the associate producers of the show, you're a fucking bold-faced rap hip-hop liar. You're a poser. Well, he's not a poser anymore because he did start listening to that. He does like it.
Okay.
He came around, right? It's not too late. Like you just said earlier, I missed that whole thing in the 90s. It's never too late. That's the beauty of music.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So, number seven is It is a great song. It's a classic song. Off the album Hard to Earn, 1994, Gangsta, Mass Appeal. Now, Guru was originally from my original hometown, Roxbury, in Boston, moved to Brooklyn. He has a monotone style. Like, his style is very monotone. And DJ Premier, fucking great DJ. But Guru actually went on to do an album. I think he did two albums with all these jazz legends while he did hip-hop to them playing the music. So it's kind of a jazz hip-hop fusion. I've mentioned it once before. And that's something that you might want to go back and listen to and check it out. Just check out Guru, right? But okay. Mass Appeal by Gangsta, that also has, that album has, and that was a great fucking album. That was their fourth album, but that was the bust out. Code of the Streets is a fucking heavy song. I like that song. And DWYCK, that's also, that's got Greg Nice and CL Smooth on it. And I actually have them in my, they were on my list, but then they got bumped because, again, you start coming up with these other songs. It's like, you got to fit it in.
You know what? And it's harder to make a list than build a car.
It certainly is. So Mass Appeal by Gangsta off the album Hard to Earn, 1994. Number eight. This song is maybe, arguably the greatest hip-hop song ever. Again, arguably. I could argue either way. I'm leaning toward yes. And it's by the late, great, Notorious B.I.G., Hypnotized. Right? Which is all built off of the sample of a Henry, I think it's a Henry Mancini song.
Yes.
Right? The break, there's a break in there. But that song, there's kind of a bittersweet thing. He died. He got murdered. I think before the album came out, and the album was,
huge.
Yeah. It was called Ready to Die. Right.
Yeah.
Is that what it was?
I think so.
And the video, he never got to see the video. They filmed the video. They had like a $900,000 budget, which back then wasn't really a big budget for a rap video because that's what they were really throwing out, some serious, serious videos back then. And he died. He got murdered just like 2 weeks before the video came out. He had only actually got to see like 90 seconds of the video. And he was all happy and he was thrilled to see that. And he was waiting for it. It was going to be a big deal. And it was a big deal. It was a really fucking big deal. You've seen the video, right?
Yes.
So everybody has seen the video, right?
It was all over. Yeah.
So little story behind that is, the producer gets this boat. He gets the owner of the boat. He says, I want to film this video. And the guy's like, yeah, sure. All right. Pay me. That's a big fucking expensive race boat, right? Here comes Puffy, P. Diddy, right? Puffy and Biggie walking down the fucking ramp. And the guy goes, oh, fuck no. No. They are not fucking driving my boat. This is a true story. The guy goes, they are not fucking driving my boat. No fucking way. No fucking way. And the producer's like, come on. The director's like, come on, man. Da-da-da. And the guy goes, there's no fucking way I'm going to let them drive the boat on their own. So they let him come on the boat, and you can't really see him, but he's in the boat while they're driving. And they said, every once in a while they'd be filming, you'd see his head pop up in between the seats, make sure everything's good, and then he kind of fucking slink down again. So the owner of the boat was actually on that fucking boat when they were doing that.
Oh,
it was pretty funny.
Did any of that make the cut?
I think there's like a little sliver where if you look hard enough, you can see him kind of ducked behind a seat. But but yeah, imagine having a fucking, it's like a $1.3 million boat, and you see fucking the Notorious B.I.G. just fucking wobbling down that fucking ramp, and P. Diddy, Puffy. You're like, whoa, 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 whoa. And that's exactly what the guy did. Fuck it's that, Jack.
It's the equivalent of seeing Pete Townsend and Keith Moon walking down and saying, we're going to borrow your boat for a little while.
yeah, exactly. All right, number nine for my boy Eric B. and Rakim, the god. The song is Juice, Know the Ledge, right? That came out, it was off of 1992's Don't Sweat the Technique, which is another fucking great song. And it was Eric B. and Rakim's last album, Don't Sweat the Technique. And it's a fucking great album.
They stopped in 92. Yeah, That's a long time ago.
They had Paid in Full in 1987. They had Follow the Leader in 88. They had Let the Rhythm Hit Him in 1990. And then Don't Sweat the Technique in 92. All four of those albums are fucking grand slams. They were just that fucking good together. And I don't know what happened. They made too much money and one wanted to do more. The other, I don't know what happened. But Rakim is, in my book, he's the greatest rapper ever. His flow, speed, fucking lyrics, smart, intelligent lyrics. If you listen to them, you're like, this dude can put shit together. Although Biggie, you got to juggle that one. It could be on any given day, one or the other. Because I'd say Notorious B.I.G. is probably right there, step for step, with Rakim is greatest rapper ever. A lot of people say Tupac. It's all subjective, right?
Yeah.
And number 10, the 90s fucking classic. The 90s, this was a game changer. This wasn't the song that launched Snoop Dogg. That would be Deep Cover 187. With Dr. Dre, but Gin and Juice off the Chronic. I mean, do I have to say anything more about that album?
No.
The fucking Chronic. That's all I got to say. Probably it's in the top five greatest hip hop songs, albums ever. It could be in the top 20 greatest albums ever. If I was to put a list together, that song, that album just fucking exploded. And Snoop was right there.
Yep.
But go back and listen to a Deep Cover by Snoop and Dr. Okay. Dre. Deep Cover. That's where Snoop broke. Snoop was friends with Warren G. Warren G. And his song, him and Nate Dogg, with that they did fuck is the name of that song? I got the Schmitties.
You're smart.
I'm smart. I'm wicked smart. I'm smart. It was Regulators. Roundup. It was a clear black night. A clear black night.
It's on the tip. Like,
the Michael McDonald song is Regulator. Yeah. Regulator is the name of the song. But the Michael McDonald's, I keep forgetting, was the sample that they used.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again. But they use that beat. It was Regulators. Round up. So Snoop Dogg was friends with Nate, with Warren G. Warren G is Dr. Dre's stepbrother. He brings Snoop to the studio. Dre is like, yeah, whatever. And he's like, no, you got to hear this guy. And he's like, whatever. Here's his tape. Listen to his tape. Dre hears the tape. Is like, are you fucking kidding me? This is something he's never heard. This is an alien right here. And that's how he got put on the Deep Cover song, which was from the movie Deep Cover with Lawrence Fishburne, which is a good movie.
Yeah.
That's the song, you're 187 on an undercover cop, because it's 187 on an undercover cop. So you got to really, that's a pretty heavy song too, so put that on your list.
Okay.
My honorable mentions, like I said earlier, Pete Nice and CL Smooth, they reminisce over you. 93 Till Infinity by the Mighty Souls of Mischief. Shimmy, shimmy, yah, shimmy, shimmy, yay. ODB, baby. Old Dirty Bastard. I couldn't have a list without Old Dirty Bastard. That dude was fucking great. He was so destined for bigger and better things. Then he dies. And actually, this is kind of an off one, but it was the first real heavy like Vato, Latino, essay. Did you spill your wine? Okay. He just finished it. Spill the wine. Get that girl.
Listen, Jack had his tuna sandwich. I got my glass of wine.
The tuna sandwich was fucking great. The tuna sandwich was
great. Remind me never to get between you two again because I couldn't stop fucking laughing that all night.
It was funny as fuck. You got the tuna. I even had to compliment the next day. I go, dude, you outdid yourself. And I still laugh at the fact that he went and made a fucking sandwich and came back and we were still talking. We're still doing on this day. He didn't care. That's fucking great. But I'd rather have that motherfucker with the tuna sandwich in his hand than that fucking guitar. And I'll stop at that. All right, the last one on my, Paris, the devil made me do it. Paris is kind of this kind of fringe. He kind of made it, but then he didn't. He was very radical for the 90s, the early 90s. Very militant, but his beats and his style and his voice was The Devil Made Me Do It is the name of the song. Was actually the name of his album, too. But Paris is like, that's like a real deep, like I'd say a deep dive. If we were going to say deep dive into music, like bringing up Paris, you really got to be a hip-hop head to remember him because he was too militant. Like X-Clan was militant, but Paris was like hardcore militant. And I don't know what happened with him. He just kind of, he probably couldn't hang anymore. They didn't want him to. And then by Kid Frost, La Raza. This is for La Raza. That shit has some smooth. He's a Mexican dude, right? So this is like, this is East LA shit right here. This is like heavy Mexican influence. And Kid Frost, La Raza, and there's some fucking smooth ass saxophone playing in that. It's kind of a nice tempo, very like a vato, a nice vato beat. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. people are like, oh, that's that. What do they call it when you take somebody's what's the term for it today? When like you dress as an Indian, it's called what do they call it? What do the liberals call it? Like identity. You're stealing the. You know what I'm talking about? I don't know, but it's anyways. What is that called? Fucking Smitty's. Anyways.
You got the Smitty's. You fucking Smitty's. I got Smitty's.
I'll remember it. I'm going to bring it up by the end of the... cultural appropriation. I just did some cultural appropriation. Because I said, what's up, S.A.? Salvato. Hey. What's up, mommy?
You know, you bring up a good point. When that thing got into rap, it was a whole different... And it was L.A. So, yeah, it's like...
East LA, you know, listen, they found their niche. Hey, listen, the Booyah tribe. You had the Booyah tribe. These are some heavy hitting fucking Samoans.
Yeah.
And they were smooth. There was a big, I mean, these are some big fucking linemen. These dudes, big Samoan dudes. Go check them out. In the video, like there's one video they dressed as gangsters. They got the big ass pinstripe suits and the hats and the gun. So, you know, it was all coming in the 90s. Everyone was trying to find their little niche.
Rap was extremely geographical, the sound. That's what I liked about it. Rock, too, to a degree, because you had the Seattle sound, but not really. Rap, definitely, because one thing you didn't touch on, it wasn't serious, but
it was Miami territorial.
Miami sound. That was total party, you know?
Yeah.
I kind of did some work with Luther Campbell. He had a thing going, but nothing he was doing was prolific. He just said, I want to give people a good time. That's all he cared about. Absolutely. You know?
And he,
but then with the beats with that, you know, the beats are great.
Well, the words, it was controversial. He knew controversy was going to sell records.
Yeah.
Luther Campbell is no one's fucking fool.
Smart guy.
Yeah, nobody's fool. I tell
people to this day, he's a smart guy. No, not him. And I'm like, no, he was a really smart guy. And he got the rights to all his music. And I love it when an artist gets the rights to their music.
That song was fucking, was busted in every club from the tip of Miami, from Key West to fucking... The border of Vancouver.
Yeah.
That shit was, you know, Me So Horny was fucking everywhere.
And it got that crowd that is worried about, what do you call it?
Censorship.
That got more
tip
attention.
The tip of gore fucking shit.
He got arrested, I believe. So he had that song, I'm Banned in the USA, Fuck Martinez.
Did you hear that song? In the USA. He got the fucking, he took the sample. Wasn't it Banned in the USA, right? Well,
did you hear that song, Fuck Martinez, about the sheriff?
Yeah.
I love it, you know?
He didn't care. Like, he knew that was going to sell records, and it did.
So when he... when he left Atlantic, or Atlantic probably left him, he started his own label, and we were fortunate in Hillsdale, New Jersey, where I worked with Tom. We did all his cassettes, but I was happy for him because he signed a band called H-Town. Do you remember Knockin' the Boots?
Yep.
That was it. He signed them, and he made it. And I was happy he made money. I don't know if he screwed
that. That was the only hit they had, but it sold records.
It sold. We did. I think we ended up doing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with a second shift just to produce all those cassettes. You know,
yeah, man. Like,
it should have been in a big factory for some big label, but it was Luke's label, and he used a tiny duplicator in a nice little suburban town.
Look at that. That's the shit right there, buddy. Yeah. Yeah. That's the behind the scenes shit, my friend. There you go.
Very good guy, though.
All right, buddy. 5 trivia questions.
I'm going to fail.
Nah, you'll do fine. Although, you and Jack didn't do too well last week, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I think he won.
But he didn't do that well. He, like the week before, I think he listened to the podcast. I don't know. I'm just, he did well the week before. Better than Tom and Lou did. Right on the same question.
Well, Tom and Lou are going to beat me tonight. So.
Nah, Lou is dying for a rematch. He's dying. But, he wants a rematch with anybody.
This is Tom forever. This is Tom.
For the podcast listeners, he's wiping his head with the
garage door open. I'm waiting for an alligator to walk in.
That was so funny. God bless him. He stuck it out.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of like you stuck it out for 2 hours, having to take a piss for 2 hours. You stuck it out.
This is his face, you know?
When I said you gotta go. I can handle it, buddy. I got
it's
it
like
for
being
a minute.
At a concert when you're in the crowd. You don't want to lose that spot. You will.
That's it.
Yeah.
All right. So 5 questions. It's a new segment on the Milk Crates and Turntables podcast. There we go. 5. Question number 1. Mark Smith, one of the co-hosts of Music Relics Podcast. Question 1. Which Aerosmith song was nominated for both Best Original Song and Worst Original Song?
I'm thinking of a song, but they didn't write it. Diane Warren wrote it. Oh.
Which Aerosmith song was nominated for both Best Original Song and Worst Original Song?
Well, it's got to be one that people get tired of hearing, maybe. So I'm going to just take a total stab. Walk This Way. Should have been a 90s era song, right?
Don't want to miss a thing.
That's what I was thinking, but I thought Diane Warren wrote it.
It's an Aerosmith song, though.
I hate that song.
So Jack got a little like huffy 2 weeks ago, I think it was. Was it last week when I asked the questions and I didn't have the detailed answer? Like, I gave him the answer and he's like, why? And I said, it's just the answer. You can't ask a question and give the answer without giving the details behind the answer. Blah, blah, blah.
Whoa. You said Best Original Song, but you didn't say a song they wrote or didn't.
He would say that.
Just kind of clear something
but
up.
But that's a category.
Yeah. But I just want to clear something up. Tom Spallone says I fart through your show. It's my chair. If anyone, you know, I can't get it to do it now, but he said the last time I was on, he's like, you farting through the show. I said, no, it's my chair.
Trust me.
I can't do it now.
Trust me. If I thought you were farting, I would call you out on that. Don't you think I would take total advantage of that?
I'm Irish. We don't fart.
You know? I would absolutely have a field day with that. I know it's your chair. I can tell it's your chair. I Don't Want to Miss a Thing was nominated for both Best Original Song at the Oscars and Worst Original Song at the Golden Raspberries in the same year. There you go. All right. Question number 2. Dusty Springfield recommended Led Zeppelin to a record label. Which label was it? Dusty Springfield recommended Led Zeppelin to a record label. Which label was it? Which is kind of an odd connection if you think about it. Dusty Springfield and Led Zeppelin.
They got around in England. I'm going to take a total stab. ABC Dunhill Records.
No, I got to do that. You know I have to do that.
Yeah, I love it.
Atlantic Records. Atlantic Records. During the Memphis sessions in November 1968, Springfield suggested to the heads of Atlantic Records that they should sign the newly formed Led Zeppelin.
But they did sign him, right?
She knew the band's bass player, John Paul Jones, that's the connection,
yeah,
who had backed her in concerts before. Imagine that. John Paul Jones backed Dusty Springfield.
He's with a lot of people.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Now, did they go to Atlantic Records?
I thought they did.
And then Swan Song came along, right?
Yeah. Yeah, their label. Right. Yeah. All right, trick question.
Question number three. Who famously said, quote, "Elvis may be the king of rock and roll, but I'm the queen"? Who famously said, "Elvis may be the king of rock and roll, but I am the queen"?
I'm thinking what logically, but I'm going to go with my heart. Elton John? You know what my second guess was?
Say it.
Tina Turner?
Little Richard.
Oh!
Yeah, Little Richard. Elvis, Little Richard, same time.
Yeah.
You're on the right track. You're in the right category. You're in the right ballpark.
I'm doing shitty. Shitty right. Schmitty.
Well, question number four. Who did Billboard magazine name as the artist of the decade in December 1999? Who did Billboard magazine name as the artist of the decade in December 1999?
Artist. So it's not a group, it's an artist.
'90s
albums here. Bono?
No.
That's my heart. That's my heart.
Mariah Carey. Yeah, you got to think big.
You got to think record sales. You got
to even if you didn't listen to her, you got to think big.
Actually, I did. I did.
There you go. There you go. She wasn't bad in the 90s.
Yeah.
Crazier than a sprayed roach, but, you know.
She had some good ballads. Some of those ballads were really good.
Yeah.
Them and the Backstreet Boys.
All right. Fifth and final question.
Has anyone ever gotten 0 out of 5 on your show?
Lou got an answer. Tom got an answer. No.
Oh, my God.
But this one. This is a very I'm going out way outside the box for you. All right, I'm going to go way outside the box for you on this one. All right. I'm going to give you, it's not even a music question.
Doesn't mean, okay? I'll get it.
So just take your head out of the music world. I'm giving you a, it's not quite a softball, but it's not a fastball either, I don't think. Okay. Question number 5.
Yeah.
What was created by Wunderlei Candy Company in 1880 that is still the best-selling Halloween candy today? What was created by, I think it's Wunderlei Candy Company in 1880 that is still a best-selling Halloween candy today? Halloween candy.
All right. I hate it, but is it those little triangle things that look like when you eat too much corn when you go to the bathroom? Corn. I got the Schmitties. Chicken. No. Corn.
All right. What gets given out on Halloween? Just in general. What gives out on Halloween?
Apples.
No. Like
Chocolate.
No. But what is chocolate? A form of?
Cocoa.
No. Be simpler. You go to the store to buy. I'm trying to give you this one. You already had one of the words. You had one of the words.
Corn.
Right.
Corn.
What do they give out? What do they give out at Halloween?
You're killing me.
What is the product? What is the product? What is the overall product? The name candy. Of the... Yeah, so, what's the answer?
Chocolate candy.
You fucking... No. No, I can't... I fucking fed this to you. I fed this to you like a fucking giant steak.
Yeah. Right?
It's... You said corn, and then you said candy, and then I said, so what do they give out? You said, but where'd you go? Chocolate bars. What the fuck? Are you fucking... I mean, people had to wait till the end of the show for this fucking gem. You couldn't have said candy corn. You couldn't... Oh, no. You got the guitar. You couldn't have said candy corn. Like you said, the little try. Oh, no, 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 no. The little, was that Rush? You were just playing a little Rush there?
Yeah, it was.
Name that tune. Name that tune. Dude, you said corn, and then I made you say candy. I fed it to you. Like, you fucking, like,
my
I
other nickname is
you with this fucking answer.
My
and
other
you
nickname
said
is
chocolate bar.
My other nickname is Numbnuts, okay?
Oh, my God. You had it, the little triangles. You just really.
You shit out when you have too much corn.
You really, really outdid yourself this week. But wow, did you fuck that one up. I'm going to ask you a question again. Hey, Mark, question number five. What was created by Wunderlei Candy Company in 1880 that is still a best-selling Halloween candy today?
Honey Nut Cheerios.
You motherfucker.
I just wanted to give you your first 0-5 on your show.
Oh, okay? You did. You certainly did.
I better go up on that wall behind you. You know, it's like
you did it good. Yeah, you got to go up next to Count Chocula, Boo Berry, and Frankenberry.
By the way, there's water dripping. Just
talking about the
kitchen.
The fuck? Not in the studio. All right. Time for top 10 singles this week in 1994. I looked at 92 and I didn't like it, so I changed it to 94.
Good.
Number 10 this week in 1994 was Don't Turn Around, Ace of Base. Number 9 this week in 1984, Funkified by Da Brat. She was a piece of shit. Number 8, When Can I See You by Babyface. Number 7 this week in 1994, Stroke You Up, Changing Faces. Number 6 this week in 1994. Well, I swear. Do you think something else I can do? All
by
for
the
one.
Way, the I start, swear. That was the start of the melding of country and R&B, because there was an R&B version and a country version.
Ah, that's
right.
And
that's right. When Sony Records said, we can combine all this. Yeah.
Good call. Yeah. Yeah. Good call. All right. Number 5 this week in 1994, Can You Feel the Love Tonight by who you thought was the queen of rock and roll, Elton John.
Yeah.
That was from a movie, wasn't it? That was from one of those fucking
Lion King, right?
Disney movies, yeah, which
that's
just a big ripoff of Kimba the White Lion that used to be an anime. They stole everything. If you ever go pull up Kimba the White Lion. It was an old anime in the 60s. Japanese, the fucking Disney, as they always do, stole the whole premise. So instead of Kimba the White Lion, you had, what was the name of the lion in Lion King?
Simba.
Yep.
Right?
That's Simba. All you Simba need to say right there.
What Disney do? Oh, wait, don't talk about Disney. Don't talk about it. You're going to get
canceled
locked down.
Disney Plus.
You get the shows, it's going to be taken down.
Cancel Disney Plus. That's all I say. Cancel Disney Plus.
But I got to watch the Beatles thing. No,
it'll be on eventually somewhere, somehow. It'll be on somewhere. Okay, number 4 this week in 1994, Fantastic Voyage by Coolio. He made a little career out of this kind of campy rap songs. They were cool. They were good. He had the look.
Is that the out? Yeah, good. Gangster Paradise was his big.
Gangster Paradise. Yeah, he had the braids, you know, and he had the fucking Marty Feldman eyes and... You know, Coolio was cool, you know? Yeah. He's all right. And then he was, I think he was a voice on the Rugrats.
Really?
I think he was. Wow. He ended up doing one of those cartoon voices. Number three. And I actually saw them perform this at the MTV Video Awards that year in 1994. Was Wild Night by John Mellencamp and Michele Indegiocello. Mm. I saw them. I actually went to an MTV Video Awards. It was pretty cool. Yeah. Cool. Pretty cool. Number two this week in 1994, Stay by Lisa Loeb, who still looks good today.
You say.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah, we've all seen that ad, that insurance ad. Yeah.
Hey, Lisa Loeb, I'm telling you, she still looks good. She's cutie. She ain't no, like, you know, runway model. But she was always a cutie. She's still a cutie today. Good for her.
It was that long ago. Wow.
1994. Yeah, Lisa Loeb in Nine Stories. She ditched them pretty fast after that song. I don't need no Nine Stories. Shit, that's nine motherfuckers I got to pay. I'm the voice of this group. That's like 10,000 Maniacs. You got 10,000 people in the band. How'd they split that money? No wonder what's her name went fucking solo. She's like, I'm out of here. I ain't splitting no money anymore. They come for me, not for you, Mr. fucking obscure guitar player. And number one this week in 1994, I'll Make Love to You. Everything. As you can tell, I never really listened to these songs. I don't know the fucking words. Boys to Men, I'll Make Love to You.
Ballads had some, they give me memories. I don't know.
In
the 90s, I was driving 60 miles from New Jersey to Bridgeport, Connecticut to work, 60 miles home. So some songs, you know, hit you.
And there was no satellite radio.
No. So I'd start out with New York City stations, then I'd switch over to Norwalk. Yeah. And
Yeah. All right, this day of music. September 7th. Yay! Jack's favorite part of the show. Yeah. Go make a tuna fish sandwich, Mark. I'll be back. All right. Then this day in 1968, Jimmy Page, Robert Plant, John Paul Jones, and John Bonham made their live debut as Led Zeppelin, but billed as the New Yardbirds at Teen Club in Gladsaxe, a suburb in the outskirts of Copenhagen, Denmark. Around 1,200 youngsters attended the show at Egegard School. Teen Club president Lars Abel introducing the New Yardbirds on stage introduced Robert Plant as Robert Platt. A local review stated their performance and their music were absolutely flawless, and the music continued to ring nicely in the ears for some time after the curtains were drawn after this show.
That's called ringing.
We can therefore conclude that the New Yardbirds are at least as good as the old ones were. Okay. Jesus Christ. Moving on. On this day in 1976, ABBA was number one in the UK singles charts with Dancing Queen, the group's fourth UK number one single and their only US number one chart topper. The song was a number one hit in over a dozen countries and stayed at the top of the Swedish charts for 14 weeks. It was a sad day on this day in 1978. Keith Moon, drummer of The Who, died. I could go into the whole story, but I think we all know how that happened. Mm-hmm. Paul McCartney's fault. He's the one that had the fucking party. Anyways. On this day in 1985, John Parr started a two-week run on the number one at number one in the U.S. singles charts with St. Elmo's Fire, taken from a film of the same name, which to this day I still haven't seen. And I
you see. Gotta see it. Just to laugh.
I know.
You gotta
see it. I know. I so have to see this movie.
Just all those preppy college kids having real serious problems.
I know. It's like 40 years and I still haven't seen it. What is wrong with me? Son of a bitch.
That was a little too accurate there.
Some people say, I can do voices. I'm pretty good at voices and accents. Did you hear me do my Brian Johnson earlier? On this day in 1985, oh boy. David Bowie and Mick Jagger were number one on the UK singles chart with the version of Martha.
Dancing. How did they get to number one?
I'm not even going to fucking talk. I talked enough about this song on the worst videos and worst songs, both episodes of all time. That is on both lists.
Just put worst the sound song of all down. Time. Put the sound down. Watch it quiet. It's fucking hilarious.
Yeah, the video of them just with no music and the soft shoe, the shuffling, and the way they look at each other. And they oh, it's fucking, are you kidding me? They couldn't have come up with a better fucking song than that.
And it's a good song, but they destroyed it.
Not by them.
Yeah.
On this day in 1997, Fleetwood Mac went to number one in the U.S. album charts with, you remember?
87?
Yep. What album?
Redeem
Yourself. Is that the name of the album?
Give Me Sweet Little Lies.
Nope.
Oh,
Jesus.
Big Love.
Number one in the U.S. album chart with The Dance. The album went on to sell over 5 million copies in the U.S. alone and spawned 3 singles in the USA, Landslide, The Chain, and Silver Springs, and earned the band 3 Grammy nominations in 1998.
No shit. Lindsey Buckingham's version of Big Love on that album, that is sick guitar playing.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. I love Lindsey Buckingham. On this day in 2001, Michael Jackson was reunited on stage with the Jackson 5 at his 30th anniversary celebration in New York City's Madison Square Garden. It ended Jackson's 11-year hiatus from performing in the U.S. Jackson was joined by Eminem, fucking sellout, Whitney Houston, Gladys Knight, Britney Spears, and Destiny's Child to celebrate the 30th anniversary of his singing career. It was a sad day on this day in 2003. U.S. singer-songwriter Warren Zevon died. Mm. He had worked as a session musician, was the piano player and band leader for the Everly Brothers. His 1969 song, She Quit Me, was included in the soundtrack for the film Midnight Cowboy. Jackson Browne, the Eagles, Linda Ronstadt all appeared on his albums. He recorded over 15 solo albums. Had the 1978 U.S. number 21 single with Werewolves of London, all-time classic. The Wind is the 12th and final studio album. The album was released on August 26, 2003. Zevon began recording the album shortly after he was diagnosed with inoperable, I want to get this right, pleural mesothelioma. A cancer in the lining of the stomach, and it was released just 2 weeks before his death in September 7th, 2003. The album was awarded the Grammy Award for Best Contemporary Folk Album, as it should be. That guy needed more recognition, but...
A folk album? Wow.
Yeah.
I considered it a rock album, you know?
They gave him some sort of category. Get him in something to win. And Disorder in the House, performed by Zevon with Bruce Springsteen, won a Grammy for Best Rock Vocal Performance in Group Duo. Songs from the album were nominated for an additional 3 Grammys. The song Keep Me in Your Heart is fucking heart-wrenching. It's the last song on the album. Mm-hmm. And to know that he wrote this, he knew he was dying. Just the video, the song, it's fucking beautiful. Just beautiful, but it's heart-wrenching knowing. And he said what he wanted to say. You know, good for him. Good for him. On this day in 2007, a new study revealed that rock stars were twice as likely to die early as the rest of us. Researchers said that the problem was so bad the industry should be labeled a high-risk profession. Jesus. On this day in 2007, a report showed that two-thirds of young people who regularly used MP3 players faced premature hearing damage. Dude, they evidently never listened to those fucking original Walkmans.
I was going to say.
Those Walkmans had, those fuckers were loud. Yeah. Like, there was no volume control. It was like 1 to 20. They went, it was like, went past 10.
Yeah.
Those original Walkmans were loud with the foam and the wire thing that went over your fucking head. Jesus Christ, they were loud. On this day in 2010, Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody was voted the greatest lighter in the air song. You know, the concerts, now they hold up phones. These fucking...
You know what I think when I hear Bohemian Rhapsody? If you're going to spew in this, Wayne's World.
Wayne's World, yeah. Let me see. It was the lighter in the air song of all time. It was voted by Zippo Lighter. Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven was voted at number 2, and Meatloaf's I Would Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That was at number 3 in the survey.
What about Dream On? I think Dream On should be in.
Maybe that was number 4. I don't know. On this day in 2016, the Chainsmokers, featuring American singer Halsey, were at number one in the U.S. singles chart with Closer. That's a good song. The song stayed at the top spot for 12 consecutive weeks and topped the charts in more than 10 countries. The song went on to become the first song to spend 26 weeks in the top five of the Billboard Hot 100 chart. That's an accomplishment. It also became only the second song in the history of the Hot 100 chart to spend 32 weeks in the top 10 of the chart. You saying Billie Jean didn't last that long in the top 10 charts? I don't know about that. That might be a little skewed. All right, birthdays today. Born on this day in 1964, the late, great Eazy-E. Died on March 26, 1995, complications from AIDS, but he never showed any symptoms. It was the strangest thing. He never showed. He was normal height, normal weight, normal everything when he died. Strange.
So it just one day, he just, his body gave out.
He got sick and then he just, but
he probably got a cold, like a sick, and because of his immune deficiency, that's what got him.
And I believe Ice Cube and Dre saw him before he died. So,
okay.
On this day, born on this day in 1957, Margot Chapman. From the American, and I only say this because this is an all-time 70s classic one-hit wonder. Margot Chapman from the American pop group Starland Vocal Band. Who had the 1976 U.S. number one hit,
Afternoon Delight.
One of the biggest selling singles of 1976. That's the only reason I put her in there.
Born I got on one day, right, Scott. I got one right.
There you go. Born on this day in 1957, Jermaine Stewart, singer of Shalimar. We Don't Have to Take Our Clothes Off. I actually like that song. In 1986, right? That was the hit. I like that. We don't have to take our clothes off to have a good time.
So we could just make our clothes dirty.
Yeah, I like that song. He also worked, you know, with Shalimar. He worked with the Temptations and Boy George. But unfortunately, Jermaine Stewart died of cancer on March 17th, 1997. Born on this day in 1956, Diane Warren, who you mentioned earlier.
Thought you wrote
US songwriter. Warren has written over 80 U.S. top 20 hits, including Aerosmith's I Don't Want to Miss a Thing, Leanne Rimes' How Do I Live, Toni Braxton, Unbreak My Heart, plus hits for Cher, Celine Dion, Michael Bolton, Rod Stewart, and Ace of Base. Damn, girl.
Wow.
That's some fucking talent right there. Yeah. Born on this day in 1954, Benmont Tench. Keyboard player for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
And Stevie Nicks.
And Bob Dylan and U2 and Roy Orbison.
Yeah. Among others.
Yeah. Born on this day in 1951, one of my 80s crushes. I love Chrissy Hynde. Best known for being the founding member of the Pretenders, one of them. Brass in Pocket, 1985, and that kind of, all right, it's kind of a cool song. I Got You Babe with UB40 was a number one hit in the UK. Born on this day in 1947, the one, the only, I Will Survive, Gloria Gaynor, disco diva. And born on this day in 1936, Buddy Holly, and that's the show, my friend. That's the show.
Okay. I just want to say, it's a great show. I was 0-5, and Sean got me on the coughing. I had a great show. I coughed into my hand. All right, sorry, Sean. I won't.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. All right. Yeah, we hit 2 hours and 13 minutes, buddy. Jesus, I don't think we can do a show under 90 minutes.
No,
I think it's possible. Imagine if we tried to squeeze an hour in. Our intro conversation is 20 minutes.
About 3 weeks ago, the Music Relish, we did an hour because I said, guys, if we have no more, cut it. And we were done. We're like, that wasn't much.
All in the conversation, the organic conversation.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, once again, my friend, I appreciate your time. I appreciate your effort. I appreciate your input. I appreciate your music knowledge.
Thanks for having me. Always have a great time with you.
It's always good, man. It's always good. I'm sure this is not the last time you will be on the show. I get a funny feeling. This is not the last time.
As long as the New York State Thruway is not closed and I'm working late, I'll be on time next time.
Buddy, you can always let me know. We can extend it. It's a lot. It's, you know, we can do it eight, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But I want to thank the podcast listeners. I appreciate your time. I appreciate you listening. I appreciate your support. For the live streamers, it gets hard to keep a crowd for 2 hours. You know, it's a scrolling world, but I appreciate you watching. Like I always say, you are the engine that drives this machine. Without you, it'd just be me and Mark having a great organic music conversation. There's nothing wrong with that, but you guys get to enjoy the knowledge. And to quote my favorite artist, Morrissey, doing the show for you, the pleasure, the privilege is mine, and I will most likely be back next week. Same time, same channel, same live stream, same podcast platforms, same everything. All right, say goodnight, Mark.
Good night, Mark.
Did you just fart?
No.
Was that a fart?
No.